The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center, Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the monthly Guest Dharma series.
Okay, so my name is Patty, and I'm a community member here at Common Ground Meditation Center. And again, thank you all for coming. Welcome back from the meditation. So we're really excited tonight to have Therese Jacob Stewart here. And a little bit about her before you get to hear her wisdom is she is a meditation teacher. She owns her own meditation center with her husband Jim over in St. Paul called Mind Growth Meditation Center on St. Clair. And it offers all kinds of great workshops and classes and just a really wonderful space to be in. She's also a psychotherapist and she's an author and she's written a few books. And her new book is Mindfulness and the 12 Steps, just came out, Living Recovery in the Present Moment. And it's just great. And the book before that was Paths Are Made by Walking, Practical Steps for Attaining Serenity, which helps me out a great deal. And some of her spiritual excursions, among many, have been studying with Tibetan monks in Nepal and India. She's also studied with Carmelite and I think Arizona Monastery. And she has also studied in the Soto Zen community out in San Francisco at Green Gulch Farm Zen Center. Close enough.
Close enough.
One thing I'd like to tell you about her is what I know of her is that she has this just wonderful, compassionate heart, or you do, I can address you. And it's just a wonderful balance to watch her devotion without rigidity and her exuberance for these teachings that is really infectious. So I just really have been greatly helped by you. And I wanted to read just a few words of let her introduce herself. These are so helpful. I keep it in my pocket sometimes when I just want to be centered. And it's one of my favorite readings from this book. Each time we sit in meditation, we can touch that very Buddha nature and the calmness at the end of the out-breath. Right in that tiny instant, before the in-breath, there's a glimmer of our true nature, a nanospace between our thoughts. Right there, at the end of the breath, is calmness. We find it in that little teeny space where we stop trying to do life all by ourselves, where we just let ourselves be breathed. At that instant, we touch our inner Buddha nature. This is our true faith. Thank you.
Thank you, Patty. It's nice to be here and see this beautiful space. It's my first time over to the new Common Ground, and it's exquisite. Are any of you here this evening for the first time at Common Ground also? A few new people, welcome. And how many of you are familiar with the 12 steps already in some kind of way, firsthand or secondhand? Just about everybody. Okay, that's good to know. I wanted to draw tonight's talk from a stanza from Shanti Deva. And I think many of you have the handouts if there were enough to go around. I thought that we could start by chanting it together. And I don't know if that's something that Mark does with you very often. I think we have enough so that if we buddy up, most of you can read aloud with us. Others, maybe if you're far away from a paper, can just soak it in while others read. So we'll go along in unison. It is a stanza from chapter 3 in Shanti Deva's very famous book, A Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. And it starts out, we're going to pick up at verse 28. So if you have your paper together, we'll just start And one of the things they do, at least at the place that I study when we're chanting, is we don't take long pauses of breath. We just keep going. So that'll be our cadence. As a blind man feels when he finds a pearl in a dustbin, so am I amazed by the miracle of awakening rising in my consciousness. It is the nectar of immortality that delivers us from death, the treasure that lifts us above poverty into the wealth of giving to life, the tree that gives shade to us when we roam about scorched by the light, the bridge that takes us across the stormy river of life, the cool moon of compassion that calms our mind when it is agitated, the sun that dissolves darkness, the butter made from the milk of kindness by churning it with the Dharma. It is a feast of joy to which all are invited. Such a beautiful stanza. Many of you might know the story of Shantideva, some of you might not. But when he was in the monastery, he was there for a long, long time and he never said anything. And all the other monks that lived with him thought he was sort of a dud. And they made fun of him behind his back, like, that guy's really just a dud. You know, all the rest of us are studying, practicing, we're applying it, and all he does is sleep and eat and go to the toilet. Such a dud. So they thought that they would trick him. And they decided that they would trick him into giving a talk, because in the mornings, once a week, one of the monks had to give some kind of expounding on the Dharma, on the teachings of Buddha. And they thought, I know, we'll just trick him into it, but we'll tell him, how about next week, you have to do it. And he said, yes. And then when he stood up to give his teachings on what he had been thinking about inside for all of these years, it came flowing out in this absolutely beautiful poetry, and they were stunned. And his teaching from that point on, he's considered one of the great teachers in the lineage of Buddhism, it's from the 7th century, has been written down in this piece called The Way of the Bodhisattva, or Guide to the Way of the Bodhisattva. How to live the teachings of mindfulness, the teachings of the Buddha, in our everyday life. And he's talking about this phenomena of awakening. And it's one of the places that the Buddhist tradition and the 12-step tradition start to weave together in their language, in that the 12th step of the 12-step tradition also says, uses the word awakening. That as a result of practicing the previous 11 steps, we experience a spiritual awakening that we then can take into all of our everyday affairs. It's been, in my spiritual journey, this process of recovery from addiction that has been such a part of what I've heard referred to as one's way-seeking path. That it's been out of the suffering of addiction, out of the difficulty and hell of being addicted, as well as growing up in an alcoholic family, and being able to reach out for that process of recovery that the spiritual awakening of sorts has occurred. Rising like a pearl in the dustbin. Such is the miracle of awakening. And up until that point, I would say that I was a fairly disaffected Catholic. Just to give you a little taste of the environment at home, my parents in the 1950s bought a house in Richfield, Minnesota, because it was one block from the Catholic Church so that we could go to Mass every morning. And yet, outside there was this wrapping of devotion, of piety, but inside there was great distress in the family. And that had turned me off to Catholic practices a great deal. The hypocrisy of it had been enough to have me go, not for me. And it wasn't until I started into recovery and practicing the 12 steps that some windows of access to a spiritual journey began to open, and then in particular through the path of mindfulness and through the poetry and beautiful language like we hear from Shantideva, that the access to an inner life began to be seeded. The seeds of that began to be watered. So I began a couple years into recovery, about 2 years into recovery. I went traipsing off to a monastery in Arizona that a friend of mine had told me about, and spent a year in silence doing monastic rhythm where you rise at dawn and meditate, and six times through the day the bells ring and you stop everything you're doing and you pause and meditate, and then you go back to what you're doing. We did work, manual work in the morning, and then in the afternoon we had silence and lived in a hermitage in the desert. At the time it was in northern Arizona. It was kind of before Sedona got discovered. And there was actually space between the houses, a great deal of space in fact. And we'd live in, each of us would have a hermitage, and you could barely see the other from where you were living. So just you and the emptiness of, and openness of the sky. When I came back from Nada, the name of the monastery was Nada, the Spanish word for emptiness, I then continued because a friend of mine in the program had told me about reading a book where Lillian Roth, who wrote a book called I'll Cry Tomorrow, again from the 50s, she was talking about her early recovery. She read a pamphlet that was distributed by internet in New York, and the pamphlet talked about how similar the spiritual movements were of the 12-step program to the Ignatian exercises. And the Ignatian exercises were a 16th century contemplative practice, a protocol that you would use for going through these steps of reflection and meditation using Christian scripture. And they had been passed down for centuries. In the old days, people used to take a month or 2 months or 3 months to do them in a very intense way, but they had been repackaged and they were available, and people could do them if you did 1 hour a day for a year. And just as my friend was telling me about this, and we were commenting about how, oh, that's odd, you know, if it was part of the 12-step practices, or it wasn't part of it, but it was closely associated, people found that they were very much like an echo of each other. How come we've never heard of them? And wouldn't you know, as these kind of odd synchronicities go, a couple of weeks later in the mail, I swear this is true, I got a brochure from the Seneca House in Wayzata, and they did the Ignatian exercises. At the time, it's now the treatment center called The Retreat. It's on the same property. But the Seneca sisters had been trained in this process because it came down from Ignatius. Ignatius founded the Jesuit order. The male side of it is Jesuit priests. The female side of it is Sisters of the Cenacle. They did a lot of work. Maybe some of you were there. They did a lot of 12-step work there. And I think that that's part of the vibe you have in the earth when you go to the retreat center. It's all those decades of people doing contemplative prayer. I think you can feel it in the energy of the trees. And it was like that at Nada, because the place that we lived at Nada was on worshiping grounds that had been used for centuries by the Hopi. The Hopi knew better than to build houses on beautiful, stunning earth. They kept it as sacred. And when you were there, it was as if those ancestors were there with you. All those centuries of sacred ritual contained in that place. Kind of like when you come here, you can feel the vibe. You can feel the velvetude of the silence, of the practice, of your practice. I went from there to study more when I could, to India and Nepal, and it was in Nepal that I took my first Buddhist initiation. And at the time, it was with Threngu Rinpoche in Baoda, Nepal. There wasn't any big ritual, but it did cut a piece of hair. And the cutting of your hair, a piece of your hair, was a ritual, a gesture of saying, I am going to let go of pursuing all that the material world says it has to offer, and I devote myself to living a life of spiritual practice. I now study with Ajahn Linda Ruth Kutz in San Francisco. In Green Gulch Farm, Zen Center is the most beautiful place if you ever are inclined to go. Really, from those studies, Jim and I decided, actually inspired by Mark and Wynn and Common Ground, when they used to have the original recipe, Common Ground, and they lived on one side and it was the practice center on the other side, and we decided that we would sell all of our stuff, and we found a building in St. Paul, and we have what we call, instead of the Zendo, for a Zen name for meditation, and we call it a Zendito, because it's really little. And we live upstairs, and we have our center, our neighborhood center, for people to come and practice, and that's what we're up to doing these days. And about 6 years ago, we started being the host for the Mindfulness and 12 Steps group of St. Paul. So the first one was brought to the Minneapolis and St. Paul area, I believe through the work of Judith Regeer, who's guiding teacher at Clouds and Water. She'd been out at San Francisco. They always start wild and crazy stuff out in San Francisco. And she brought it back and started a Mindfulness and 12 Steps group, or Buddhism and 12 Steps group, at the Minnesota Zen Center. And then, thanks to the work of Craig and Alice, another one was started here at Common Ground. And then we were the next one to say, hey, how about if we have one across the river? Maybe people will come, even if they don't usually cross the river. And 6 years ago, we started our chapter. The book Mindfulness and the 12 Steps really came out of those meetings. What I envisioned was that if people who don't have those meetings in their area, or people who want to go deeper into this practice of integrating 12 steps and mindfulness, could be like a fly on the wall at one of our meetings. And that's how it came about to be. I think one of the reasons that those two paths and the intertwining of those two paths have been so valuable to me is because for me personally, stopping using drugs was kind of the easy part, and that wasn't very easy, really, but it was easier than learning how to live without them. And I had my own kind of mini awakening in the hospital. I had been using amphetamines steady for many months and collapsed at the Uptown Art Fair in the middle of August with 104 fever. And it had been diagnosed as spinal meningitis. So I woke up on a bed of ice in the isolation ward. It wasn't until I had been in the hospital for 4 more weeks and the diagnosis had been changed to a pretty severe case of mononucleosis that it dawned on me that I wondered if it had to do with all those amphetamines. And I had the same doctor, Dr. Schultz, who used to make house calls to my grandmother. And he never asked, because it didn't really fit with the image of my family. Together, this integration of mindfulness, there is, as many of you, know, practice the 12 steps, the 11th step that we seek through prayer and meditation to seek constant conscious contact, with a power greater than ourself, or in Buddhist language, our Buddha nature. But together, mindfulness and 12 steps have indeed been a tree giving shade from the scorches of life, a bridge to take me across the stormy river of what life brings to my door, a refuge from the delusions of the addictive and codependent mind. So if this is a way-seeking path that leads us to spiritual awakening, I wanted to talk a little bit, drawn from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, about what are they talking about? You know, we hear it in the language of Buddhism and mindfulness as the arising of the bodhicitta, that through practice the bodhicitta spirit arises, the heart opens. The big book talks about it a little bit differently, but the language is interestingly similar. The big book says that there are two kinds of spiritual awakenings that we experience working the 12 steps. The first kind is what they describe as something that's immediate and sudden, where you have one of those kazam moments when things are clear or when you are touched. The way the founders of the 12-step program talked about it was that the experience is one of a sudden God consciousness. A sudden God consciousness that's followed by a vast change in feeling and outlook. Followed by a vast change in both feeling and outlook about life. About self, about life. Some examples of those kinds of kazam spiritual awakenings come from the founders of the 12-step program, who experience having a kind of sudden white lightning type of experience, and they no longer were haunted or riddled by their compulsion. We can think about Mother Teresa. I love her story. Mother Teresa's riding along on the train in Yugoslavia. I always imagine that that train was probably a little bit rickety. Hearing stories from some of Jim's bicycle trips in that region where you go to the hospital and you're lucky if you have windows. Makes me think the train might have been rickety. But she's riding along. And she's a teacher, you know, she's like, has a nice life, comfortable, living in her community, teaching elementary school. And as she's going through the mountains in Yugoslavia on the train, she hears a whisper in her heart of hearts that says, "Go and serve the poorest of the poor." And you know, if you or I had that kind of whispering, I wonder if we wouldn't think that maybe we were just having a drug flashback. And maybe we think that we were kind of crazy. But Mother Teresa takes it seriously. Mother Teresa believes in the whispers of her heart of heart as an experience of conscious contact, and she leaves her comfortable life. She takes a leave from her order and she goes to Calcutta and she starts scraping up the people on the sidewalk. And it becomes her life work. The other story we are all so familiar with is the story of Buddha himself. Buddha, who sits under the Bodhi tree after his years of wandering and searching. When he has his moment of enlightenment, some translations say what happens to him is that he sees the way things really are. The Four Noble Truths, or sometimes in some translations called the Four Insights on the Way Things Really Are. And after he has this moment, and he's walking along, runs into a stranger, and the strangers are like, hey, you know, that guy's got something. Looks kind of luminescent. And he comes up to him, the stranger comes up to Buddha, to Gautama Buddha, and he's like, hey, what are you? Anyway, are you some kind of sorcerer? Are you some kind of god? And Buddha goes, no. Okay then, I've got it. I've got it. You're a magician. No. Okay, an angel. You're an angel. No. Well, what are you? Buddha says, I am awake. I am awake. And Buddha then goes on to teach us about how to become awake. What the big book in AA describes as the experience of awakening is this, that when we are awakened, when we've had a spiritual awakening, this difference in change and feeling and outlook is that we can look the world in the eye. We can look the world in the eye free of shame. We can be alone and be at peace and at ease, free from loneliness. And our fears will fall from us. We are free of fear. I think that that's where that phrase that's so popular in 12 Steps comes from. You want what we have. People see that kind of awake energy, that kind of freedom, that kind of liberation, and then are willing to go on their own way-seeking path. There's a second kind of spiritual awakening, however, the one that's not such a kazam, that's described in the big book. And this one is called the educational variety, the one that's more the slow drip. And they say that this one often is happening to you and you don't know it. Actually, that probably your friends will notice it before you. And they'll see some differences, because this is the kind that develops slowly over time. And what it's described as, we undergo a profound alteration in our reaction to life, particularly the difficulties. I think that this is this process that Buddha is talking about in the Second Noble Truth, that if our difficulties and our suffering is a dependent co-arising, meaning it's the outside event, but equally as much, it's your internal response to it. And it's the combination of the outside and the inside that makes for the recipe for suffering. That the spiritual awakening is undergoing this profound alteration in our reaction to life. We find the pearls in the midst of the dust and the difficulty. And what is it that's happening when that's going on? What the big book says is before, we might have had spiritual beliefs, ideas about spirituality, ideas about the spiritual path, But now we have direct spiritual experience. We are tapping in to an unsuspected inner resource. The way the 12-step language reads is this: we find the great reality deep within us. We find the great reality deep within us. Other words for that is that we experience our essential self. That's what the yogis call it. We become aware of our true nature. We realize our Buddha nature, the Buddha within. And the last one that I love, we remember our original face, the one that was there all along. That through the experiences of our life, the ideas that have become developed about who we are, the shame, the fear, the loneliness, tangle all over it, and we've forgotten. But with awakening through practice of meditation, we remember the original face that has always been there all along. And how is it that mindfulness and meditation practice help us cultivate the conditions for this spiritual awakening to arise? Because I think that they have a direct relationship, if we can cultivate the conditions for spiritual awakening through our practice. We can help it along. So one thing that happens is that through practice we start to disidentify with our mind. In 12-step language, we call that step two. If coming to believe we can be restored to sanity, we start to disidentify with our mind. I think this is one of the very valuable parts of practice. So when we're sitting, you may have your experience of this, and you're watching your thoughts go by, and what we're doing when we're on the cushion is that we're letting them go by. We're watching them, watching them, watching them, watching them. We're practicing non-reactivity. We're noticing the nature of our mind, and we're doing nothing about it. We're just watching it go by. And so instead of believing that our thoughts are real, we start to know that they're just thoughts. Oh, that's just a depressed thought going by. Oh yeah, that's another one of my worries going by. I don't know if this is your experience, but it's certainly when I'm sitting on the cushion and tagging thought and tagging thought and tagging thought, a lot of times it's the same kind of thought. Planning, planning, planning. Worrying, worrying, worrying. Criticizing, criticizing, criticizing. Oh yeah, that one again. But I think if we don't have mindfulness, those thoughts are reality. We think they're real. This is one of the profound changes that alters our experience of reality, is that we stop believing our thoughts. We start to see that they're mental constructions, or as Eckhart Tolle calls them, mental phantoms. Mental phantoms going through. Like one of his favorite phantoms that he talks about, which is, I'll be happy later. I'll be happy later when my bills are paid. I'll be happy later when I've lost these 5 pounds. I'll be happy later when I have a good relationship. I'll be happy later when the person I love that's in the throes of addiction gets well. Then I can be happy. But not until. Stuff like that. in addition to being able to see our thoughts go by and start to loosen our grip on them, you know, as the Buddha talked about, what's the cause of our suffering? It's either trying to push away what we don't want or cling to what we do want. So we can't disidentify until we can see our thoughts to start with. The second thing we start to see are the actual habits of our mind. The actual internal formations that have become solid inside of us that are now the habits of our mind. Or what Chogyam Rinpoche used to always call the portable stage set that we carry around with us everywhere we go. Have you ever had that? New situation, same drama. New name, same characters. Whole new situation, and I'm playing the same part. I am the tragic heroine once again. How come every time I draw the short stick? Or maybe my way is to make everything irrelevant. That's one that happens often in alcoholic families. But just make it irrelevant. Nothing really matters. Nothing really matters. I was working with a client on Friday, and she was talking about this cave that she lives inside of. And on the outside world, she's extremely accomplished. Extremely accomplished. But her habit of her mind, her belief, is that no one is trustworthy. She came from a very violently alcoholic family. She was raped as a young woman. She herself is a recovering alcoholic. And she said, "Don't try to tell me that everybody out there isn't a little beep, bleep, bleep, if you can fill it in. They're all a bunch of..." That would be an example of a formation that we hold inside that has become solid, and it's now a belief about life. Like, I'm not safe. Like, people will let me down. Like, I have to save the day. Because no one else can do it. Da-da-da-da. Here I come. Maybe part of what we see in the habit of the mind is that there are certain aspects of ourselves that we have disinherited. Parts of ourselves we don't want to be true. Like, I'm not really like that. Thank you very much. We're working on this. I'm doing over at Mind Roads a year-long, was kind of a nine-month year-long, Tonglen intensive. So we're doing very intense Tonglen practice. And the first part one is Tonglen for self. And so we're working with different aspects of ourself where you would put it on the zafu and zavatan or the cushion out in front of you, and you're doing Tonglen for a wounded or disidentified aspect of yourself. And it's very, very profound. Maybe one of those aspects that's disinherited is the one that, like, gets to be happy. I know myself, I really, for a long time, did not trust it. Wait for the other shoe to drop, because it's going to. And so, like, a happy, carefree part was very foreign to me. So we see our thoughts, and then we go deeper in our practice and we start to see the habits of our mind. We see the internal formations that we carry. These are the teachings of the establishments, the sutra on the establishments for mindfulness. We see what's carried in our body. We see what's carried in our mind. We see what's carried in our heart. And we see the formations that have developed inside that are now beliefs that have solidified. And the Buddhist idea about this is nothing is really as solid as it seems. These ideas we have are just ideas. They are not necessarily true. We can see in that kind of practice how we create our own reality many times with our internal response to whatever is happening around us, with our internal response to whatever life brings to our door. To quote Tenshin Reb Anderson, another teacher at San Francisco Zen Center, he sums it up like this. What you are is not all of what you really are. What you think you are, excuse me, what you think you are is not really all of what you are. Who you are is already attained, always, at every moment, who we really are is not who we think we are. It's our Buddha nature. And then Tenshin Reb Anderson continues on to say, and we aren't a Buddha nature because we're such, he doesn't exactly say it like this. That we aren't a Buddha because we're such hot stuff. He says it differently and much more poetically. I remember now where it is. It's not something special about you that makes you a Buddha. It's simply being you that is Buddha. It's not that you are such a virtuous person, so virtuous that you're a Buddha, but that being you is Buddha. Just being you is Buddha. So mindfulness helps us cultivate the conditions for awakening because we start to disidentify with our mind. Another thing it helps us to do is to arrive in the present moment, that place that we rarely are, because we're usually like in the past or in the future, or if you're like me, you're into planning. But the practice itself actually creates a neurological pause button to all of that ruminating, all of that mental activity. We know from studies that if we practice mindfulness regularly, that the neural activity in our left prefrontal lobe is going to increase. And what that does is create a neurological pause button to our reactivity. Whether we're in addiction, and so our reactivity is, I can't stand this, get me out of here, I'll have a few, or maybe a carton of ice cream, or whether it's that we're codependent and we can't stand this, and so we have to manage and control them so we can finally and at last get what we want. It creates a neurological pause button to that kind of habituated response. We can arrive in our body, the teaching that all of us are so familiar with, a monk knows when she is sitting that she is sitting. A monk knows when he is standing that he is standing. A monk knows when she is lying down that she is lying down. We come here. When we're here, it's in this moment that we can experience that spiritual awakening is the cool moon of compassion that calms our mind when it is agitated. some of you heard me tell this story, and I'll give you the short version of it. The other day I was talking about it at the Monday night meeting, but I was talking about my nephew. My nephew is having a hard time. My nephew was partnered with someone who he's now separated from, and they have a 6-year-old daughter. And he is going to court as the unmarried father of the daughter to try to get custody of her because her mother is not taking her to school and her mother isn't getting her fed and her mother isn't keeping her company, and he's very worried about his daughter. And he's not a particularly spiritual young man. He actually smokes a lot of dope. I'd say he's probably a little bit of a baby maybe addict. And so his daughter is now, he got her enrolled in a local school, and she came home apparently from the library. She had a book, and the book was called Zen Shorts. And he was telling us about it. Because the first story of the book, as he was reading it to his daughter, teaching her her letters and her words, was that story about the farmer, you know, whose cows run away, and the neighbors all go, oh, how horrible. And he goes, maybe. And then his son decides to go chase the cows down and bring them back, and falls and breaks his leg, and all the neighbors come over and say, oh, how terrible. Now you lost your cows and your son has got a broken leg. And he goes, maybe. Yeah, maybe. And then the king comes through, and he's decided to conscript all the young men and take them into service. And because his son has a broken leg and is laid up, his son doesn't have to go. And the neighbors all come over and say, wow, great good fortune, that's wonderful. And he says, maybe. And my nephew Patrick was telling me that when he read that story to his daughter, all of a sudden he thought that the difficulties of his life that he was thinking were such a disaster, that maybe there was something in it that would turn out good for him. And he said, I didn't hurt as bad, because I just started saying to myself, maybe. Maybe it'll be as bad as I think, but maybe not. We start to come into the present moment. We begin to touch that spot between the thoughts. And in that spot between the thoughts, we can sometimes find, as Shanti Davis so beautifully said, that spiritual awakening is the cool moon of compassion that calms our mind when it is agitated. And the last point I want to make about how mindfulness helps cultivate the conditions for spiritual awakening is that it helps us to begin to abide in being rather than doing. We used to have a class at, we haven't done it for a couple of years now, but we called it Dismantling Habituated Patterns. And part of the process that we did in that class was to write a vow. And I think that is a very interesting practice, to set an intention. And the structure that we were using for setting the vow was to first talk about the behavior that was in the present that you were struggling with. And then to see if you could get to the root of it, the second line was supposed to be like what the root of it was, kind of why you were doing it. And then the third line was your statement of intention. And your fourth line was what you wanted to be able to let in instead. I mean, we always would start out with the dedication, which was that I make this vow with the help of all living beings. And so for several years, I worked with the one for myself, which went something like, you know, with the help of all living beings, when I get consumed in doing, and think that I am not good enough and must do more, I vow, with the help of all living beings, to stop and relish in being. Katagiri Roshi described it like this: the freedom we are seeking is the pure and clear state of existence where nothing is missing. And this, of course, I think, is this hole inside of us that in addiction we're trying to fill. This craving, this yearning, whether it's from an alcoholic family or whether it's loved one who is addicted. We're trying to fill this hole. The freedom we are seeking is the pure and clear state of existence where nothing is missing. The place where all we can do is just be. Then from that place, truth comes up. From that place, new life comes up. So let's accept our profound desire to be free from suffering and learn to touch the depth of human life that is beyond our ideas and feelings. The freedom we are seeking is the pure and clear state of existence where nothing is missing, the place where all we can do is just be. Then from that place, truth comes up. From that place, new life comes up. So let's accept our profound desire to be free from suffering and learn to touch the depth of human life that is beyond our ideas and feelings. Shantideva called it that spiritual awakening is the sun that dispels darkness, the butter made from the milk of kindness by churning it with the Dharma. We begin to abide in being. When the mental formations clear, because we can see them, we disidentify with them. We come into the moment instead. The truth rises up. The clear seeing allows us to touch our true nature. And the force of compassion is automatically released. Thought I would read you a story that I wrote about my days at the monastery. I had an experience of simply being, a moment when all self-consciousness fell away under heaven's canopy. The sky opened wide over the red rocks and desert sand at Nada. There were no buildings but our small hermitages, no billboards, no cars. You could see clearly in all directions. Whenever I went walking, I always wore my sturdy red wing boots. They were made of tough brown leather, too thick to be pierced by a rattler's fang. Scorpions were no danger. I was safe to roam, exploring the gorges and hills. It was easy to lose track of time, not seeing another human for hours. Me and the butterflies and the groundhogs. I took to singing aloud. Full tilt. No one but the lizards and juniper trees to hear. Off key or on key, no matter. I used to do the same thing when I was young as I tramped the cornfields across the street from my childhood home. When I was 6 years old, the lean stalks of corn were my green giant friends. They were gentle, protecting me from burning in the glaring sun. The dirt smelled of dung, and grasshoppers buzzed. I could get lost, invisible and free. Wandering in the world of corn spirits, I made up child songs, belting away in my own innocent world. Mother couldn't see me, but she could hear. She'd later say all she had to do was stick her head out the back door and listen for a while, and then she'd know where to look. While meandering around the desert lands surrounding Nada, I felt safe and free. I found that child self again, and so I sang. One favorite pastime was composing various melodies for the Canticle of Mary. From Christian scripture, it is Mary's prayer expressing wonder at the news that she is with child. Just a regular, lowly person. She is awed to hear the news that her child is a great being, the Messiah to come. She says, from Luke chapter 1, "My soul proclaims the greatness of the Lord. My spirit rejoices in God, my Savior, for he has looked with favor on his lowly servant. From this day forward, all generations will call me blessed." I can't really explain why I was so drawn to Mary's Canticle. I just kept singing it time and again, rolling it around in my mind, having it pop up like a bad Chevrolet commercial. It said to me, she felt loved, honored, even though she wasn't worthy. I identified with the not worthy part. Still, Mary was chosen and blessed. Maybe being worthy wasn't all it was cracked up to be. One late fall afternoon at Nada, I was walking and singing, kicking up dust with my red wings. Soggy gray clouds lined the horizon, backlit by a sinking sun. Wide strokes of golden pink stretched across the sky, touching the cosmos. Everything was illumined, held in a breath of time. I could see clearly. The prickly cacti thorns, yellow and pink desert blooms, and scraggly sage were all part of the magnificence of creation. Tarantulas, diamondbacks, and buzzards, too. None had earned their place through virtue or worthiness. Like Mary, it was their very being that made them blessed. Surely, me too. I belong to this great creation. For a moment, I remembered who I really am. I returned home, singing. And so as we think about the spiritual awakening that's promised or foretold, as a result both of Buddhist practice and 12-step recovery practice, we experience the miracle of awakening. as a blind man feels when he finds a pearl in the dustbin. So am I amazed by the miracle of awakening rising in my consciousness. It is the nectar of immortality that delivers us from death. The treasure that lifts us above poverty into the wealth of giving to life. The tree that gives shade to us when we roam about scorched by life. The bridge that takes us across the stormy river of life. The cool moon of compassion that calms our mind when it is agitated. The sun that dispels darkness. The butter made from the milk of kindness by churning it with the Dharma. It is a feast of joy to which all of us are invited. I think we have a few moments for questions or comments or questions.
I was watching your feed yesterday, and it said, be yourself, you're the only person this long with. Chris, I was wondering why you were looking directly at me when you mentioned ice cream earlier.
Wasn't that you at Izzy's the other day? Other comments or questions? You're welcome. Yes. Do you mean from your religious tradition, from being Lutheran? Well, you know, I think many people here might have comments on that, but certainly I think that Dalai Lama and Thich Nhat Hanh all advise that we, you know, stay in our historical religious tradition if we wish, that there really isn't a conflict if you want to practice the mindfulness practice or follow the way. I think it's only the other religions that have a problem with it. I don't think Buddhism has so much of a problem with it. Well, how about if we do close for the evening, and then we'll hang out and have fellowship and tea, and we have some propaganda on the table. Jim will be out in the hall if you're interested in a copy of the book. And would you do three bells, or I'll do three bells. I always like to, when we close our meetings, do three bells. I don't know if Mark does this. Oops, just got water on his beautiful one.
Okay, Mark's not here.
Mark's not here. So it's to ring three bells is just to take a breath with each bell and then let the vibration of the bell to send loving kindness. I always do the first bell, loving kindness to ourselves and then to each other here and then out beyond the walls. And I think because of tonight's topic, we'll send it to our loved ones and particularly people and families in recovery. Listening to the sound of the bell, letting its vibrations send loving kindness to our hearts. May we be peaceful and happy. Listening to the sound of the bell. May its vibrations send loving kindness to each other, to those here in the room. May we know the miracle of awakening. Listening to the sound of the bell, letting its vibrations send loving kindness to all beings, particularly those struggling with addiction or in families where there's active addiction. May they know the miracle of recovery and awakening. Thank you for your practice.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.